My name is John Schramm, and the session today is a Bible study on Philippians with the subtitle, Can We Enjoy the Feast in an Ordinary Congregation? And the particular emphasis today is living in grace. I have to tell you, and this is as much for the tape as it is for you, yesterday's did not get taped. And so the tape ministry has asked me to review ever so briefly what we did yesterday so that we can build upon it. And if you weren't here yesterday, that'll be good because you'll get to catch up just a little bit. We started our study of Philippians. We all read it. And we had as the major point that Paul, when he writes, assumes a common unity. And how important that is for us if we want to have a foretaste of the feast to come, to have a sense of common unity, because then the diversity, which is wonderful and means growth, has this common unity first. We even put it this way. Your congregation, does it agree on the question? For instance, a good question, what does faithfulness to Jesus Christ mean for us at this place and at this time? Then you can have a variety of answers, but you're agreed in the question. And we ended yesterday, the list could have gone on and on, by saying, have the ways, find the entry point where this community is being built. And there's lots of entry points, theological entry points, liturgical entry points, going on a retreat, having small groups, the way you make decisions, consensus decision making, builds community more, I think, than winners, losers, aye, nay, majority vote. What we didn't mention yesterday is architecture. Does your church invite community? Maybe you ought to unscrew the pews and have chairs in a circle or something. Does it? So, whatever the entry point, really maximize this as one of the things that you want to work for in order to have a foretaste of the feast to come. That was yesterday. Today we have grace. I have a friend who's a former Lutheran. She said, I found that there was a lot of talk about grace. I didn't experience very much. Our hope today is that grace is not only the doctrine on which the church stands and falls. I think that's accurate. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, for by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is a gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. That's the doctrine on which the church stands or falls. But today our hope is that it's not only the doctrine on which the church stands and falls, but the experience of those who are in that congregation, that you experience gracefulness and a grace-filled community. That's our premise and that's our hope. Obviously, the difficulty is, how do you talk about that? How do you communicate that? Let me tell you a story. Yesterday, I related to you a family story. Our best stories are our own stories. You know that. Everyone can be a storyteller. And I think the greatest tragedy is to live your life and miss your story. So it's good to be able to relate them. Yesterday, I told you we moved into the center of Washington, D.C. Even told you about our son losing his first bicycle, a birthday gift from his sixth birthday, and it got stolen within a week. Well, let me tell you a little bit more about the place to which we moved. We moved a block away from DuPont Circle in Northwest Washington, D.C. It, at that time, was the runaway capital of the East Coast. I used to say to our four children, you can't run away, you're already here. This is where you would come. It was the flower children, the hippies. DuPont Circle was filled with soapbox orators, chess games, bongo players, flower children, frisbee throwers. It was wonderful, right in the middle of Washington, D.C. In fact, every Saturday at the P Street Beach, Now, I have to tell you that that's a really fancy name for a little bit of grass along a very muddy, smelly tributary of the Potomac River, but we called it the P Street Beach. Every Saturday, there was a bee in. If you can't remember back to what those are, let me tell you, oh, it's wonderful. Wonderful for strong introverts like me. You went and all afternoon you just were. Remember those? You never went? Oh, wonderful. Well, with all of these kids there all the time, the Presbyterian Church right up on the hill over the P Street Beach said, we're going to get us a missionary to all of this humanity that has come into our neighborhood. And they found an Irish Presbyterian pastor named Tom Murphy. Wonderful man. So they called him, and he looked out over his parish, and on a Saturday decided, I'm going to go down there where all the folks are. So he had a short-sleeved black clergy shirt with a clerical collar, and he had some leaflets under his arm, and he moved into the P Street Beach. Well, the first hippie that he met, ponytailed, freckled face, good smile, said, look, Father, assumed he was a priest, look, Father, if it's not immoral or illegal, I don't do it. Tom took one of the top sheets and rolled it up, got his own grin and said, this is not immoral and this is not illegal, but you do it. And he punched it at him. Kid opened the flyer and this is all it said. If you want to take a leak, come over to the Church of the Pilgrims and use our bathroom. How about that as a start? The first missionary brochure, right? Wonderful start. Wonderful start. The word spread. Hey, they're okay over at that church. You can go over there and use their bathroom. Tom couldn't have picked a better start. From that came all kinds of ministry, including the mustard seed. Mustard seed was open every night of the week. It was the whole basement of the Church of the Pilgrims. Safe place, no pressure, soup, maybe some clothing if you need it. There was a telephone if you wanted to call home. Some kids really did want to call home. It was well done. You know the kind of thing that you respond to human need. We're going to have sessions this week of meeting people on the streets where they are. This week has a banquet of offerings, friends. I've been to Holden a long time, and many times the teaching staff this week is a banquet. Don't miss the problem is choosing between two things at the same hour. Anyway. Once in a while, Tom got some that were causing a little trouble or hard to handle, those he sent to our house. He was a friend, but I didn't want too many more friends like Tom. We lived a block away. Well, one night he sent four aggressive arguers, and they were having the time of their life on our back porch in the inner city of Washington, D.C. They had an ordained Lutheran pastor over 30, and a Benedictine monk, friend of mine, and they were on us. Have you ever, I guess if you're a campus pastor, you get this all the time. Here was the question. Ultimately, you two, what's the difference between a mature secular humanist and a mature Christian? And we weren't doing very well. Now, lest you think we didn't have any answers, we were long past selfish and unselfish. They had pictured a mature secular humanism whose altruism went beyond any church member or pastor I have ever met. And we were long beyond moral and immoral. They had posited a mature secular humanist whose morality was just without fault. And now, what's the, if you've never been pinned, well, whether it was the hour, it was 11 o'clock, and I don't do well. After that, when I was the director of Holden, it was known that if you came to Chalet 4, about 10:30, I would stand up and say, Mary, we're keeping these people up. So whether it was the hour, or whether it was the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, or whether it was that I had had a couple beers, your piety will check one or more of those possibilities, for whatever reason, I said, finally, there is a difference, and it's important. Well, they perked up, because Dunstan and I hadn't been doing very well. I said, finally, the Christian will have a better sense of humor. And they got interested. And I had the finest conversation I have had in my life about grace. That's 30 years ago. If you'd push me, I still have the same answer. Ultimately, the Christian has a better sense of humor. You know what I mean. I don't mean a better stand-up comedian. You know what I mean. Take they then life, goods, fame, child, spouse, when they their worst have done, they yet have nothing won. Because the kingdom ours remain a God-given nonchalance, because I don't have to prove anything. That should give us a better sense of humor. Why are we so heavy when we're the ones who talk about grace? Why? My neighbor in Minnesota took a trip to Canada, and she got back, and a friend of hers, another neighbor, said, "How was your trip?" She said, "Oh, it was awful." And her friend said, "Now, are you just talking Minnesotan, or did something specific? Did something really happen that was bad? What do you mean?" She said, "Oh, it was terrible. I almost didn't get across the border." And her friends, "No one has trouble going from Minnesota to Canada. You don't have anything to hide. Your car's inspected. Your driving is, what do you mean?" She said, "It was those questions." She said, "They ask you questions." "Yes, yes, I got in trouble with the very first one. They said, 'Where were you born?' I said, 'I was born in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me.'" She said, "They dragged me into this booth." She said, "I think I should have just said Duluth." Heavy. Why? Is it okay to talk about grace as a better sense of humor? Is that a way to get it? I think it is. I don't think that's trivializing. We've got to find a way in which this doctrine becomes part of the way we live, part of our life, so you not only hear a lot about it, but you experience it. Mark.
We had a pastor in Minneapolis who added humor to the gifts of the Spirit.
Oh, good for him. Good for him. He'll be in trouble with certain theologians, yeah. But good for him. All right. What I'd like you to do is take Philippians. As you know, it takes about 7 minutes to read it. Look for grace. Find grace in what Paul says, in how he says it, in unusual places. Now, for you who are now bothered that we're asking you to look for it and we haven't defined it, go for it anyway. Read it without our definition first. Okay, read Philippians in about 7 minutes. Aware of looking for grace. Grace abounds. Almost wish you had your own Bibles and could highlight the passages. I just wonder how much of Philippians would have been yellow had you done that. Anyway, turn, and threes are really good for this. You know that. You get a couple other opinions you get to share, and it's not too many for the 2 minutes we have. Share with other people where you found grace in Philippians. Point to a particular passage, a mood, a reaction you had, but just share a little bit, because we don't have, when we come together as a whole group, we don't have time to hear anybody, everybody, so you at least get to share a little bit. A couple minutes, we move quickly, so just change your chairs so you're with a couple other people. Good. We talked about power yesterday in her session. Yeah. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me" is probably the RSV. I have the same New English Bible, but that's a good section about the fine line between stoicism and what Paul talks about in the way of his handling of his troubles is a very helpful distinction. Stoicism, you kind of put down your own feelings and it's your strength, and here it's the Spirit's filling Paul with what he needs. Good. Other places.
Well, and he follows that then in verse 19. You know, he says it about himself, and then he reassures them at the very end of the letter that that will also be the case for them.
Yep.
"And my God will supply every need of yours according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus."
Good. Yes.
I like the piece where he talks about forgetting what lies behind.
All right.
You know, sort of the freedom of that comes from that.
And good.
What grace delivers us from those burdens.
Right. Good.
Excuse me, that, I'm trying to find Brent Wiersma. I need to talk to him. Is he here by any chance?
Wiersma? No, I don't think so. I know I'm to see him, and he isn't here. Go up into the office there in the hotel and ask.
He's not there. I thought he might be down here.
Okay. Sorry. Good luck. Yes?
Grayson, in his situation, he's in prison, and yet he sees that as a good thing because the word is being spread through him there.
Good. She mentioned yesterday, this is all written from prison. And how many times did you find cheer, joy, or rejoice? Did you count them?
Yeah,
it's over a dozen, I think. I started circling them. Okay, good, good.
He said we should be blameless before God.
Blameless. Does somebody else have a different... Then on the day of Christ you will be flawless and without blame is mine. What do you have for 10 or 11? The New English Bible is hard to... Read that in your RSV.
And be pure and blameless.
Pure and blameless, okay? That Greek word means that you didn't offend others with your goodness. That's a kind of graciousness that's necessary for you to have the witness you need. Last week I talked about our community of Christ in Washington, D.C., and we had one woman who was blameless in the other way, meaning she always had some pious thing to say and she was always right. And one of the members before we worshiped one time, when she had one of these little speeches that she often gave, turned and said, "The arrogance of your Christian humility makes me vomit." Our congregation was fairly direct with each other. So the blameless is that you have not offended with your goodness, but it has been attractive to other people. That's a grace, a gracefulness, graciousness. Good.
It says in chapter 2 that you may be blameless and innocent.
Okay.
Children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you shine as lights in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's pretty good. Where else did you find? Couple more. These are great. Yeah.
This isn't grace, but it troubles me in 4:17, where he says, "Not that I seek the gift." He's talking about the gift of the Philippians that extended to him. "But I seek the fruit which increases to your credit."
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a non-grace kind of statement.
That God's giving them credit for being generous, giving them points in their stars in their crown because they were good at their offering. Okay. Got another way to read that?
Still a fundraiser.
Still a fundraiser, ultimately, Paul. This is when you get to the final part of the letter from the fundraiser, you know what it's all about.
Concerning, it says, "I seek the profit that accumulates to your account."
What's Paul doing with that? Give another reading to that. It's a kind of metaphor or a illustration from accounting, sure. But how would you read it more gracefully instead of?
Isn't he saying that the benefit in the end is really theirs?
Uh-huh. Is that, I mean, is there not a truth to that? Yeah. That you're the one...
rejoices and...
You're the one who finally benefits if you're generous.
It fits into the spirit of St. Francis' prayer.
Okay.
It is in giving that you receive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. It'd be another way to
it's
say
a
it.
Growth in grace.
Okay. Anybody else is gonna kind of just burst if they don't get to share? I don't want somebody frustrated all day because you really did have something and I didn't give you a chance. Anybody? Yes.
I'm not about to burst.
Okay, that's all right.
But verse 21 in chapter 1, "For he to live is Christ and die is
the..." All right.
That is really full of grace for me.
Good. The letter literally starts and ends with grace. "Grace be unto you and peace." And how does it end? "The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit." So the word itself is in there. And I think we've described it beautifully. I'm glad you felt it was awash with grace, or everywhere, or whatever the first things were. I'm not opposed to trying to describe it more with some kind of definition or description. I just think it's hard to do, and that our living in the letter and our talking about it, even stories about it, there's a great irony right now. If you read the autobiographical sketch on the board about the teaching staff this week, it says John and Mary Schramm have a story in Leavenworth. That's a wonderful misprint. Literally, we have a store called Jubilee, but what we really have is a story in Leavenworth. That's wonderful. Anyway, so if we tell some stories today, I think that's okay. I told last week, but I can tell it again, a friend of mine interviewed for a congregation, and they asked him a definition of grace, and he told a story. And one of the theological professors in the congregation didn't want to call him. He said, when we asked him for a definition, he told a story. And one of the lay people said, I think there's good precedent for that. And my friend got the call. But Frederick Buechner often is fresh with stuff. So I looked up, I always keep this book close, Wishful Thinking, A Theological ABC. You just look it up like a dictionary under the spell, alphabetically, and they're really good. It's an old book, but here's what he says about grace. After centuries of handling and mishandling, most religious words have become so shop-worn, nobody's much interested anymore. But not so with grace, for some reason. Mysteriously, even derivatives like gracious and graceful still have some of the bloom left. That's true, isn't it? Grace is something you can never get, but only be given. There's no way to earn it or deserve it or bring it about any more than you can deserve the taste of raspberries and cream, or earn good looks, or bring about your own birth. A good sleep is grace, so are good dreams. Most tears are grace. The smell of rain is grace. Somebody loving you is grace. Loving somebody is grace. Have you ever tried to love somebody? A crucial eccentricity of the Christian faith is the assertion that people are saved by grace. There's nothing you have to do. 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 That's a nice way to put it. The grace of God means something like, here is your life. You might never have been, but you are, because the party would not have been complete without you. Here's the world. Beautiful and terrible things happen. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. Nothing can ever separate us. It's for you I created the universe. I love you. There's only one catch. Like any other gift, the gift of grace can be yours only if you'll take it. But being able to reach out and take it, that's a gift too. Sounds like Philippians. Work out your own salvation for fear and trembling. For it's God who works in you, both to will and to do of his good purpose. Grace. E.B. White says it this way. It's a crummy, crummy, crummy world out there. And it is. Come to Jonathan's session on Rwanda, or repeat it. It's a crummy, crummy, crummy world out there. And if you don't know it, we'll give you a field trip. Can you arrange it?
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful world out there. If you don't know that, we'll give you a field trip. And when I wake up in the morning, I don't know if I'm called to save the world or to savor it. And it makes it very hard to plan my day. What we're talking about is taking that tension. It's a crummy, crummy, crummy world. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful world. And stretching it like a violin string until life sings. That's grace. It's not the denial of the crummy, crummy, crummy world. It's stretching that tension until life sings. How do we do that in an ordinary congregation? Do you experience it where you are? I hope so. Do you bring it to where you are? I hope so. How do we do that in an ordinary congregation? Pete Steinke. Class, tomorrow we have a visitor. Hope you'll be here on time and be polite to our visitor. Pete Steinke is going to do systems, a look at the church. Last week he had wonderful sessions. What we should have done is to know ahead of time, we'd have gone right from Philippians into looking at a healthy congregation and what anxiousness does. And, oh, it's just wonderful. Well, he's going to do some of that tomorrow as we look at Philippians. What does it mean to have a feast of the foretaste of the feast to come? So we're going to have some of that, but leadership is important. Pastor friend of mine wanted to start using the green hymnal, and his congregation had the red. Well, they had just gotten the red hymnal. They really liked the brown hymnal. It was years until, they had just bought it, and the green one was now out. But the pastor friend of mine really did believe that the green was better for worship. I do, too. I think that was a great, it's old now, but there were a lot of liturgical breakthroughs for a congregation to be a community with this new hymnal. New hymns, role for an assisting minister besides the presiding minister. It's just a great, I think, step forward. But no way were they going to have another change. You missed Walt Bowman's How Many Does It Take to Change a Light Bulb? He had one every day at announcements, and that was earlier in the summer. But when he got to the one, How Many Lutherans Does It Take to Change a Light Bulb? Change! Oh, there's some great ones. They're not on tape. But how many psychiatrists does it take? Just one, but the light bulb really wants to change, has to want to change. So the Lutheran pastor friend of mine set up a committee to study liturgy, and they did that for a long time, but decided against the green hymn. You know the story. That just wasn't going to happen. He called the 800 number to Augsburg Fortress and just made a unilateral decision, and they came in and he put them in the pew rack. So the people came in one morning, and there was the red one, and there was the green. So he looked out and smiled and said, "Would you all please take out the green hymn?" And he said, "Would you please do as I say? Hold that green hymnal about 12 to 14 inches away from your face and all go." And they did. He said, "Would you all do that again?" He said, "Would you put the green hymnals back? We're going to worship with the red hymnal." Well, you know what happened. Within 6 weeks, they could try the green one a little bit. Was that graceful leadership? Oh, yes. Oh. I don't know if they can teach you that at seminary, but we need a little more of that. I had a friend, a Missouri Synod pastor in Washington, D.C., in a downtown Missouri church. Good church, not active politically or socially. Good folks. He loved it there. There was a point in the Vietnam conflict that we just went too far. It was one of those invasions, it was just violated everything, just war criteria and arrest. And some of the students who were not politically active, suddenly that was too much, and they came to protest. Whole group of Missouri Synod students from a church school came to D.C. This was it. They were going to say no to this. And they called up my friend Saturday night and said, "Can we sleep in your church?" He didn't have time to call a congregational meeting, called a couple of the leaders, but just made a decision, yes. So the next morning, the church came to worship, and it was filled with sleeping bags and students and protesters sleeping all over the church. So my friend, I think, made a good decision. He changed his sermon. And the sermon basically was, why are all these people sleeping in our church on the floor? And why are they protesting this? Well, one man came out so angry that he hugged the wall over there. And Roy had his hand out and he said, "I'm so angry I can't even talk." And Roy said, "Could you by Wednesday?" He said, "What?" He said, "How long does it take you to cool down? Or would you be able to speak by Wednesday?" 3 days. I guess so. And Roy spent a whole afternoon with him. Both of those were pastoral acts. Saying yes to the students who needed to speak and spending time with a good man who was offended by that action. Both were pastoral acts. Both were gracious. Okay? Do you have stories about how it can be done graciously? And you're good.
Well, I just started a Lutheran for about 10 or 15 years, and then I was asked to serve on a committee to renovate the sanctuary and bring in a table of the Lord, move the choir out, come back in that way far back corner, bring them out a little bit, and camp the pews, and a couple other things on the list. And so I was asked to convene that first committee, and I was about 30 years old. And then when I was about 35 years old, they got rid of that committee and formed another one, and I was asked to convene that. When I was about 40 years old, we finally got a table of the Lord. And I thought, well, this must really be what it's like to make change in the church. Uh-huh. I think I went into that pretty naive.
Uh-huh. Somebody else.
I saw a moment of grace yesterday along the creekside. I took my youngest grandson fishing, and he was very confident and thought he knew a lot about fishing. And when we got out there, he was having troubles. And I had never, unfortunately, learned to fish. But along came a little girl, just kind of wandering in, and she was a little older than he, and she said, could I try? And she tried, and then she taught him all that she knew about casting. Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful to watch her gift of grace, of a skill. And he practiced for the next hour just learning to cast under her tutelage.
Great. Garrison Keillor joined the Lutheran Church because of grace. That's what he said. He was not a Lutheran all his life. Everybody who's listened to Prairie Home Companion thought he was. It was not long ago that he joined in New York City at the church. Of course, typically, Garrison Keillor, he said, I joined because of grace. There's absolutely nothing you need to bring. Heaven is free. Of course, it doesn't hurt to bring a covered dish.
I have a really good friend is a late-stage alcoholic man, a Vietnam vet, and has probably had 300 or 400 tickets for drinking in public in Occidental Park. And one day, Marcus came and had in his hands a wounded pigeon, and tears were running down his eyes. Mm-hmm. And he wanted me to take him to a vet so that he could get this pigeon taken care of.
That's
he just
great
wept.
Pigeon. Yeah.
That was gracious.
Yep. Thank you.
Love for creation.
That's great. Thank you. Yes.
John, the thing that has fascinated me is the Hebrew word from which I believe Paul draws the concept of grace, charis. That word, chesed, is the most oft-used description for the nature of God, more than any other word in the First Testament that addresses the nature of God. It is that word.
Thank you. Chesed. Undeserved mercy, or describe it in Hebrew. What can you picture it? Or
there's two books written on the subject.
Okay,
just on the word alone, Catherine Duke Salkenfeld did her doctoral thesis on it. Chesed in the Bible is the title of the book. It's fabulous.
Okay,
and Abraham Heschel.
Yes,
has one of Chesed. Yeah. Description. Who? Boy.
Tell them the story.
Not time. God is a God full of gift to all. God acts, that the grace of God, the chesed of God, is in the actions of God.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's never just passive. It is always in action. So everything that God does is expressed in the First Testament as God's chesed.
Great.
Look at a concordance and just follow it through.
Okay. Heschel is a wonderful writer and said, you think there's not grace in the Old Testament? Look at Sabbath. Sabbath says the world won't end if you take a day off. Wonderful, wonderful. And Heschel almost died, and a friend visited him after this near fatal heart attack, and he said, oh, when I realized I was still alive, there wasn't any anxiety, there wasn't any dread, it was just absolute gratitude. He said, as I said in one of my books, I never asked for success, only wonder, and you gave it. Let me share that part of grace. I was so glad Buechner mentioned rain and things of the created world that grace us. I always turn to Gerhard Frost to see if there's a poem. Gerhard Frost has a book called Seasons of a Lifetime. He just received a box of crayons, a birthday gift. Deluxe it was, with more than 70 colors, and oh, was he a proud little boy. And whenever he found an audience, he'd empty every crayon out, then separate the color families and extol the beauties of each. Once when the process ended, he surprised a viewer. He reached for one special crayon, the periwinkle blue, and saying as he held it high, "This one is so pretty, it makes my eyes wet." He didn't say it makes me cry. Young as he was, he knew the difference between grief and an encounter with the transcendent. What a marvelous poem. Oh, makes my eyes wet. That's a grace. There's so much sharing you can do. I'll pamper myself. I'm going to tell you a story at the end, and then we'll quit. Let me tell you a story. This is Robert Fulghum. I just love his stuff. If you're a storyteller, you can't help but love Robert Fulghum. We had matins last week. All I ever really needed to know, I learned in kindergarten. This is Robert Fulghum about himself in the 60s. Back in the 60s, I was stuck in my spiritual journey. I didn't know how to get there from here. And confusion reigned in the kingdom of my mind. Then I heard about enlightenment, that one could sit absolutely still and suddenly have total comprehension. That would do. So I decided to get Zen'd. I made arrangements with a Zen monastery in Japan, and I connected myself with a Zen master. I got my airplane ticket and flew to Japan, and I shaved my head and put on a gray robe and lined up with the other novices. I was going to be a pretty holy man in pretty short order, like within 6 weeks when my return airline ticket expired. But it didn't work. The position that you sat in when you prayed gave me leg cramps. And the food gave me diarrhea. And the hard bed gave me a bad back. And even worse than all of that, all of the other monks laughed at this Western fool. Do you know the kind of situation? They all know something you don't know. You know enough to know that they know it, and you don't know, but you don't know what it is that they know that you don't know. But I did know it was time to go home. And then, just before I left, there was a message that I was to have a private audience with Manabu Kahara, the head of this whole Zen monastery. I mean, that's like the delivery boy being invited to lunch with the CEO. No guest ever got invited to his private prayer chamber, and I had the invitation. Manabu Kahara was the reason I chose this particular Zen monastery. Graduate of Tokyo University with 4 degrees. Could speak 7 languages, consultant to industry all over the world, solver of all Zen cones. If Manabu Kahara didn't know what it was, there wasn't a person in the world who knew. I accepted. Manabu Kahara met me at the door, ushered me into that which was both his office and his prayer chamber. He bowed and I bowed, he out of politeness, me out of awe. And then he kneeled on this small cushion, and I kneeled opposite him. And then very slowly and deliberately, Manavukahara took one hand to his backside and scratched in that place and in that way that your mother said never to do in public. And then he spoke. Hemorrhoids. I have hemorrhoids, he said. They hurt and they itch. I had nothing in my mental repertoire to respond to the first words of Manavukahara. I tilted my head slightly and tried to look thoughtful. Hemorrhoids come from stress, he said. Managing this fire trap of a temple, having lunch with businessmen, raising the money it takes to keep the whole enterprise going, the quality of novices who show up and say they want to be monks, and then all the time living with a wife and three children who are not, and he got that little tilt to his head, who are not quite as holy as I am. Sometimes I just want to go to Hawaii and get a little place looking out over the ocean and play golf. Before I was enlightened, I had the hemorrhoids. Now that I'm enlightened, I still have hemorrhoids. And he motioned that the conversation was over, and that we were to get up. But he ushered me into the opening kind of entranceway of this whole temple, and there was a scroll there, and it was in Japanese, so I had seen it every day and could never read it. He said, as we stood in front of that scroll, "Go home. You came here, a thirsty man, standing knee-deep in clear, flowing water. Go home. But before you go, let me read this to you." And he read it first in Japanese, very slowly, and then in English. "There is nothing you must be. There is nothing you must do. There is nothing you must have, and there's really nothing you must know. There is nothing you must become. But it helps to know that fire burns, and when it rains, the earth gets wet." And he said, "There are consequences. There are no exceptions." And he turned and walked down the hall. He was still scratching his backside. Was Robert Fulghum Zen? I don't know. But he was graced. Bye-bye.